Hello, and welcome to episode 49 of the Sci-Fi Podcast from Bloomington, Indiana. I'm Nick Zoutra. On today's podcast, I am pleased to welcome Dr. Vincent Hendricks, professor of formal philosophy and director of the Center for Information and Bubble Studies at University of Copenhagen, Denmark. Vincent's work deals with modern mathematical and philosophical logic and concentrates primarily on bringing mainstream and formal approaches to epistemology together, from epistemic reliabilism, counterfactual epistemology and contextualism to epistemic logic, formal learning theory, and what is called modal operator epistemology. Vincent's work with the Center for Information and Bubble Studies focuses on the nature, structure, dynamics, noise, and resolution of what are called bubbles. Bubbles are usually considered unwelcome and destabilizing phenomena associated with finance and real estate markets. Generally, a bubble has developed when assets trade at prices far exceeding the estimated fundamental value. The guiding research principle of the Center for Information and Bubble Studies is that bubbles essentially amount to information control problems among deliberating agents who are collectively susceptible to robustly demonstrated socio-psychological features like boom thinking, group thinking, and lemming effects, which together determine market models and conditions which may make for bubble hospitable environments. So by aligning problems of bubble formation and miscellaneous markets with information control problems, Vincent brings together philosophy, economics, logic, social psychology, information theory, behavioral science, and computer science to form a novel and thoroughly interdisciplinary platform for analyzing and resolving often destabilizing bubble phenomena of human and market interaction. In his recent work, Reality Lost, Markets of Attention, Misinformation, and Manipulation, co-written with PhD student Mads Vestergaard, Vincent analyzes the nuts and bolts of the information market, the attention economy, and media ecosystem, which may pave way to a post-factual democracy. Here, misleading narratives become the basis for political opinion formation, debate, and legislation. To curb this development and the threat it poses to democratic deliberation, political self-determination, and freedom, Vincent and his co-author argue that we first need to grasp the very mechanisms and structural conditions that cause it. And thus, without further ado, let's bring in Vincent. Dr. Vincent Hendricks, welcome to the Sci-Fi Podcast. How are you this morning?
Thank you. Very good, sir. The sun is shining and it's Indian summer in Copenhagen.
Beautiful, beautiful. How is Copenhagen this time of year?
Well, usually it's very rainy and fairly unpleasant. However, this year, probably due to climate change, things have been fairly nice. The summer is extremely hot, probably too hot for this kind of place. But, climate change has its perks, but mostly they're all backwards.
How long have you been there?
Well, I've been on and off. I'm 48 years old by now, right? So I was born here, but I spent a good part of my life in the U.S. I was doing my PhD at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh.
Oh, wow.
And I was professor at Columbia for a while, visiting professors. So I've been back and forth all my life. My father's American, my mother is Danish.
Cool. And so for our listeners, Vincent is the professor and director at the Center for Information and Bubble Studies. Is that right?
That's correct, sir.
That's cool. Can you tell us a little bit about bubble studies?
Yes. Usually when we think about bubbles, we think about if not the ones in draft beer or champagne, we think of situations in finance in which assets, that could be everything from stock, real estate, to financial derivatives, what have you, systematically trade at prices that far exceed their fundamental value. Now, by the age of information, there is a new asset, which was actually prophetically anticipated by Herbert Simon, Nobel Prize laureate in economics from 1978. Back in 1971, and I was 1 year old at that time, he prophetically said about the information age to come, in an information-rich world, you're going to find a scarcity of something else, a scarcity of whatever it is that information consumes. But what information consumes is pretty obvious. It consumes the attention of its recipients. So there you have it. Everything today in the information-rich world is about attention. And attention may is the thing that you allocate by information. So you can see that there would be a market for putting information into circulation that allocates a lot of attention independently of being true, suppose. Welcome to fake news or shit storms and what have you. So you can overheat other kinds of assets than monetary assets. And one of them in the information age, the prime one, would be attention.
All right. So yeah.
And so what we are studying at the information Center for Information and Bubble Studies are the fundamental idea that comes from finance or economics when it comes to bubbles, but then applied to assets that are of a different sort of nature, and that could be that could be attention. And so we are looking at everything from the developmental trajectory of shitstorms on one hand to the way in which social psychology is part of generating these storms on the other. It's a combination study between philosophy, math, science, economics, social science, social psychology, and other disciplines. So an interdisciplinary center along those lines.
Wow. And I imagine this is, I don't know the history of the bubble studies. Do you happen to know a little bit about, like, at what point did this kind of mass connection of disciplines, especially bringing over disciplines from things like finance, economics, and applying them to things like social psychology, when did, who came up with this? When did this start happening?
Well, I mean, coining the term bubble studies is something that I came up with when we applied to the Carlsberg Foundation for the grant that established the Center for Information and Bubble Studies. So you can say, okay, as a coined term, it's a fairly recent thing. I hadn't seen it before, but of course, the entire idea of combining everything from philosophy on one hand to economics, social psychology on the other, to study various aspects about human nature and rational interaction and irrational interaction has been in the works for the past, 30, 40 years.
Yeah. Fair enough. Well, I'm excited to hear more about what you guys are doing here at the Bubble Studies, what kind of projects you're doing. Before we get into that, let's take a step back and let's get back to your origin story. So, Vincent, you mentioned you grew up in Copenhagen. Tell me a little bit about that. What was it like growing up in Copenhagen?
Well, I mean, Copenhagen is very different from what it used to be. It's globalization hit Europe too, and it certainly hit Denmark, and it certainly hit Copenhagen for the past, 10, 15 years. Before that, Denmark was a much more secluded place up north. So I think it's fair to say that Denmark is more cosmopolitan now, or Copenhagen in particular, more cosmopolitan now than it ever was. But back in the day when I was a kid, you have to realize that 88% of the Danish population derives from the same tribe, so to speak. So it's a very homogeneous population as compared to, say, the U.S. And from that perspective, I'm part black, part white. So those were more to be more like a statistical singularity in Denmark at that time, especially coming from America, where my father's American. So,
wow.
It was interesting growing up, fairly quiet. But since I'm also part American, you get the natural flamboyance, and I have a very close relation to New York City. So, a bit of this and a bit of that, it's fair to say.
Okay. What kinds of interests did you have growing up? What were you interested in?
Well, my father was an engineer, or is an engineer. So everything that could move and had an electric motor in it was interesting to me, especially radio controlled cars and whatnot. So I grew up with a father who was who taught me everything from electronics on one hand to radio controls on the other. And as a kid, I indulged in that and doing various sports as kids do.
Okay.
And then I took up a particular interest in writing as a very early on, and in drawing illustrations. But never to the extent of being artistic about it, but to the extent that I could see that it could serve a purpose even in my field. So a lot of the things that I came to do, as you know, often enough you don't see many illustrations in philosophy, but I reason much better with illustrations and drawings, and I grew up in math, really, and logic, right? So everything from drawing your diagrams on one hand to getting an idea of what the topological space looks like on the other generates some very beautiful drawings, which is actually good for understanding. So the entire idea that everything has to be in syntactic strings with no illustrations was always alien to me. And so if you look in many of my books, there's a lot of illustrations in them, if for no other reason than to clarify the thought, at least for myself.
That's really something. I don't think not enough gets said in terms of the way in which we reason. And I know in the sciences and in mathematics, we're often doing things where we're sketching out ways in which we relate concepts, information, and yeah, it's something that, or maybe we do some kind of illustration even in our heads, so to speak, when we're thinking about things. Can you recall any time, I guess, in terms of developing your illustrations and your way in which that has advanced your thinking in philosophy, like, I don't know, helping you tease apart a concept or represent something?
Yeah, I mean, even basic concepts. So take notions like underdetermination, Quinean underdetermination, or human underdetermination, or something to that extent. Situations in which there are two possible worlds ascribing opposite truth value to the same hypothesis in such a way that the evidence remains the same forever, independently of which worlds are the ones which is actual. So that's underdetermination for you in a little more technical possible world terms. But you can draw that very nicely, and you can see very nicely exactly how underdetermination works, as opposed to, say, local underdetermination, which is more related to the problem of induction, which you can also draw in many different ways as to how much data you have seen and what sort of predictions or projections you want to make from that data. So from that perspective, taking worlds and chopping them into pieces and making them discrete rather than continuous and see what you can get out of that has been a big part of it. And a lot of what the studies that I did in philosophy were on the borderline of epistemic logic and topology, or formal learning theory and topology. And there you draw diagrams, you draw the illustrations all the time, because otherwise it's hard to figure out exactly what you do. And then you then retranslate them into gammas and deltas and epsilons and subset signs and whatnot. But you don't do that immediately.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay. Well, yeah, I love. Have you included any of these illustrations in your work?
Sure.
Sure. Okay.
I mean, if you take my first monograph from 2001, it's called The Convergence of Scientific Knowledge, it came out with Springer Nature. Mm-hmm. Has a lot of illustrations in it, and subsequent ones, mainstream informal epistemology that came out with Cambridge University Press in 2006, also has a lot, and especially the kind of stuff that we do now has a lot of illustrations and. You know, material gathered from the net, from the web, from tweets to polarization studies on Twitter, on Facebook feeds.
Yeah. No, you make a good point. All right, so you know, as you're coming of age in Copenhagen, you know, you had an interest in writing, an interest in illustrating. Was philosophy on the radar at that time? What did you want to do?
Okay, so that I can actually answer pretty crisply. So when I went to high school, I like the humanities and I like the sciences, so I needed some sort of field in between the two. And their philosophy was presenting itself rather strongly because there's a little of this and a little of that. Although that being said, I would have to say that I got pretty disappointed in philosophy from the outset, insofar as to say that, you know, history of philosophy is being presented with a lot of theories about this and that. And once when you figured that you got Kant and understood that he was right and Hume was only had half the story and Descartes the other half, you all of a sudden realize that Hegel thinks that Kant got it all wrong. And now you take your time to figure out what Hegel had to say, and then you realize, and so forth and so forth. So this entire idea of pro and con all the time. So I developed very early on a keen interest in logic, because that's a matter of what will follow from what on what premises and what not.
Sure.
And what are the correct means by which we process information, and which ones are the incorrect ones. So I early on took a solid interest in logic, basically because it provided me with a scaffold or a set of tools by which I could study almost, if not everything, then at least a lot of different issues that I found of interest, especially when it came to knowledge and belief and the way in which they may be defined and transferred between agents, etc. And that's basically how it came to pass that I started to be interested in bubble studies, because I was interested in mathematical models of socio-psychological phenomena, from lemming effects to bystanders.
Yeah. So I see here you began. So right away you found yourself into philosophy and logic at the University of Copenhagen, and then doing a master's as well in doing a thesis on epistemic logics for AI, artificial intelligence. Can you tell me a little bit about that project? How you got interested in that, and what that turned out to be?
Well, I was interested in informal models of knowledge representation, really.
Mm-hmm.
And those are studies that pretty pointedly came out of one particular philosopher from a book from 1962. It's called Knowledge and Belief, An Introduction to the Logic of the Two Notions, which was written by Jaakko Hentikka, who died recently, and who I actually became very close to by the end of his life. And I was interested in those sort of studies. And why I was interested in that was because I was basically had a keen interest in epistemology. And there, epistemic logic, doxastic logics, and dynamic versions of those come in pretty handy to study everything from knowledge transmissibility issues on one hand to the way in which we collectively reason on the other. And so here you had yourself a set of tools that you could use to study these things. And my master's degree, and you have to realize that epistemic logic has grown exceedingly advanced over the past 20, 30 years, because a lot of different scholars took interest in it, not only philosophers, but also linguists, theoretical computer scientists, and a host of other people, and a host of other fields took, even economics, yes? Mm-hmm. Say, Robert Allman's agreeing to disagree result is epistemic logic in disguise. So, just to say, my master's degree was basically just a rehearsal and understanding of these kind of different logics that were keen and in vogue at the time. And especially there was something called non-monotonic logic that was pretty fancy or in vogue mm-hmm. in the late 80s, early 90s. And so I basically did a systematic studies of some of these different logics. It wasn't particularly original, but at least I figured out what it was all about.
That's something we can do in philosophy. We can try to clarify, certainly.
That's right.
And so I see, with an interest in formal logic and formal epistemology, seems like you went to a good place in studying at Carnegie Mellon, one of the top places to study. What was that like?
Tough.
Tell me about it. What was it like? Yeah, coming from the
Okay, so it had got, it wasn't too hard for me to obtain my master's degree from the philosophy department at the University of Copenhagen. So when I sat down in Pittsburgh because I wanted to do a PhD in logic and computation at Carnegie Mellon University, I thought, well, since it got me that, it was pretty easy for me to get so far. Maybe it's not too much of a question of what Carnegie Mellon can teach me. And by implicature, what I could teach them, which at best is ridiculous, and at worst is even worse, because Carnegie Mellon is tough. These guys are smart, let me tell you. And so I was holding on to my fingertips, just to keep my bearings. And my PhD advisor, after 4 weeks, said, "Look, Vincent, you're not one of the smartest PhDs I've ever had, but." You can work pretty hard. And I got pretty frustrated with that comment until I realized that everything you do is 10% talent and the rest is hard work if you want to get anywhere with it. And so what my PhD advisor, Kevin Kelling, was really telling me is that there's also room for you, but there's no free lunch. Mm-hmm. It's 24/7, we always open, never closed. And that was actually, I'm grateful for him today for saying that, because it kept me modest and it kept me honest. And at the same time, it also taught me the value of working hard, and that's what we do in science.
Yeah. So in doing the formal epistemology and in working in your PhD, how connected were you to the philosophy of science?
Well, very closely connected, because basically my PhD is about the structure of inductive problems. From a formal learning theoretical perspective, that's Kevin T. Kelly's specialty. And so my PhD is about a particular belief revision program called AGM belief revision, which was developed by, among others, a famous Swedish philosopher. His name is Peter Hjertenfors. And he developed a model for how beliefs change when you receive new evidence. Along certain principles, and those principles that he celebrated in the book are pretty closely related to the ways in which Kuhn thought that paradigms tended to change. And so from that perspective, it had close ties with philosophy of science, insofar as philosophy of science is also about rationality and the way in which our belief states change in light of new information. And from that perspective, it's extremely close related to philosophy of science. And on top of that, what I was interested in, and you can see that in the title of my first book from 01, it's called The Convergence of Scientific Knowledge. And that's basically the idea that we may at any given point, we will have only this much knowledge, apparently. But is there a state after which we will be having converged to the truth and nothing but? And would we know about this point, yes or no? And so I started combining epistemic logic with the structure and nature of inductive problem from formal learning theory. And we've developed this modal operator theory paradigm, which basically was the groundwork of what I did for the first half of my career, probably.
Okay.
And that is philosophy of science.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, no, thanks for clarifying that. So it sounds like a tough time in the PhD, but a humbling time nonetheless, and it sounds like something that you're quite grateful for. Yeah, so what came next in terms of, getting a formal position, working in your career? How did the job search and or finding a position go for you?
Okay, so I was blessed insofar as to say that when I got back to Copenhagen, the Carlsberg Foundation actually whipped me up with a postdoc grant to finish my first book. However, I only got to sit in that position for about 6 months. And by that time, the University of Copenhagen opened up a tenure assistant professorship, and I applied for that. And I got it. But I only sat for that for about a year, because then my old master and mentor and good friend, and now unfortunately dead, professor of philosophy of science at Roskilde University, which is a smaller university outside Copenhagen, opened up an associate professorship for us to build the department down there. It was called the Science Studies Program. So I went to Roskilde University for some 8 years. And then at some point realized, and in the meantime, then things went really fast from there, because I became editor-in-chief of Synthes, the journal.
Yeah, yeah.
In 2005, and I was editor-in-chief of Synthes for 10 years, along with John Simmons, who's now he used to be at University of Texas, El Paso, but now he's in Kansas, and then Johan van Bentham from Amsterdam. So we were a triumvirate. Turning in many ways Synthes, if it wasn't already, into a journal for formal philosophy. And so we ran that journal together for 10 years, which were fun. And there, of course, things started to develop really quickly, and I got an idea about how to combine mainstream epistemological concerns with formal epistemological concerns. I wrote this book for Cambridge that came out. It's called Mainstream and Formal Epistemology. It came out in 06.
Yeah.
And then I started worrying about, a lot of what I've been doing has been about individual agency, right? So what is the singular agent able to know in and by him or herself or itself, if it's a computer, say? But how does knowledge traverse between agents? So if Nick tells me, I know that P, and I know that Nick knows that P, does that entail that I also know that P? And that's pretty easy to prove, because at an iterated version of axiom T with different agents. But if you're looking at learning mechanisms, it's not that tricky. It's not that trivial, actually. And so I started worrying about knowledge transmissibility between agents and how agents reason collectively. And once you start doing that, you're not only looking at situations in which this actually goes well, because in many ways it does, but you're also looking at ways in which collective reasoning will create a suboptimal result. And that's when you get into social psychology and the way in which lemming effects and bystander effects and spirals of silence and all the other classical issues from social psychology will actually turn out. And by that time, epistemic logic was fairly developed to the point where you can talk about multi-agent systems. And then you can start studying these phenomena, which had been in many ways reserved for social psychology and empirical studies, but now we're actually amenable to formal studies in ways so you can uncover the structure and the dynamics, intrinsic structure and dynamics of socio-psychological phenomena. And that again led to this whole issue of start worrying about the way in which we reason together. And since the internet is, and since we reason together almost continuously now because of the web, you could see that there is a lacuna for making various systematic studies of everything from social psychology on speed to the way in which Twitter storms develop.
Yeah, so you mentioned social psychology on speed. I imagine you're interacting with other social psychologists, other folks who are interested in collective reasoning or collective social behavior. How do you, so what would you say, how do you communicate to them the benefits of taking a formal approach using these tools, because they're not familiar with these tools. These are, you know, as coming as a psychologist, my background was in psychology. We didn't learn formal epistemology. We had, we learned, sort of base psychological theories. We might post, a lot of it is more biological in nature to kinds of explanations. So how, or even mathematical models. So what kinds of tools, how do your tools and the tools you're developing and working with, what do they add? And how can they kind of, help to explain?
That's a very good question, Nick. So basically, logic is all about uncovering structure. That's all. That's basically a set of tools for uncovering various structures.
Yeah.
And when you're looking at many of the social psychological phenomena, you can look at them as social psychological information-born phenomena, right? So a bystander effect is a situation in which nobody will do anything because nobody will do anything pertaining to an accident. And there could be many reasons for that. But one reason also has to do that you are making observations about what the other agents are doing, and then you are making up your mind as to what you should do based on what the other agents either do or do not. Now, that's an information theoretical problem because it's about your gathering information and reasoning accordingly. And social psychologists are very open to this kind of understanding of the issue. This is not to say that this is the only and all there is to say about it, but it does give you a pretty formal grip of what the informational structure of this problem is. And that is not to say that it is only and solely an information-driven or information-controlled problem, if you want to talk engineering about it, but it is to say that part of the argument as to why people will do what they do and reason collectively debts has to do with the fact that they misinterpret the signals that they get from others in a certain way. And that could be studied by information theory or computer science or logic or formal epistemology, whatever you want to term it. Right. I don't really care about the terms or the disciplines as long as it works.
Gotcha. Okay, fair enough. Oh, I see that. All right, so why don't you tell us a little bit about some other projects you've worked on, maybe perhaps that the either you feel like have most contributed to your career and your research. You've mentioned a kind of an early book. Why don't you tell us a little bit about some of those?
Yeah, so I think it's fair to say that the book, the sort of dedicated philosophy book that made the biggest dent, if any dent at all, was this book that came out in 2005, which was called Mainstream Informal Epistemology. It came out with Cambridge University Press in New York. Mm. And these are sort of systematic surveys of the way in which formal epistemological approaches and informal epistemological approaches tend to be everything from problems of skepticism on one hand to knowledge attributions on the other. And so that book it's not very long. It's about 160 pages or 150 pages. And it was a systematic survey of all the standard approaches to epistemology from Nozick's counterfactual analysis to Lewis's elusive knowledge, etc. And so, but that was in a certain sense, a very purely puristic philosophical project. What I've been doing ever since then, and there is a story to be told about that, because in 2008, I received what's called the Elite Research Prize by the Danish Ministry of Science and Innovation, and which is a very prestigious prize. And my son, Milton, who was 18, he was 8 years old at that time, so that was 10 years ago, there was a lot of stir in the press about me receiving this prize because it was very fancy. And so one of his teachers in school had gone up to him and congratulated the son that the father had received this prize. And the very morning I was going in to receive the prize at a museum with the Secretary of Science and the Crown Princess and whoever else was there, he popped me a couple of questions that I've been trying to answer ever since. The first one I can do, but the second one is still in process. The first he asked me, listen, Dad, I got to ask you something. what is it that you do? which which in and by itself is a pretty good answer.
It's a fun one.
But that's the one that we can usually answer. But the second one is the one that takes the prize. He goes, why is it important? Why is it important? Now, those complicated topological studies of knowledge convergence and the limit for certain infallible types of knowledge, Now, in a certain sense, yes, they are important because they uncover some of the structure. But what I've been trying to answer that question for him ever since as to how philosophy can feed into not only addressing bigger pictures, bigger problems, but also solve bigger problems. And you have to realize that that philosophy can be very aggressive if it wants to be, but it can also be very seclusive if it wants to be. And realize that ever since 2013, World Economic Forum has been saying that misinformation on the web is now to be considered a global challenge on par with climate change, inequality, health issues, et cetera, et cetera. So there's an argument for why studying misinformation is important, because it undermines democracy. And so that was basically for me a wake-up call, because I like to subscribe to the idea, once we are talking philosophy of science, that's called scientific social responsibility, namely the idea that science should be part of addressing and solving some of the grand challenges this world is facing, from inequality on one end to climate change and misinformation on the other. And if these fundamental structural studies of dynamics, a reasoning process and collectivist, and why Twitter storms develop as they do, can be used to bolster us against living in the information age and making us more enlightened, which we don't only get just because we get a lot of information, then that's what philosophy should be used for. So we recently came out with a book, which you can actually download for free from Springer Nature. It's called Reality Lost, and the undertitle is Markets of Attention, Misinformation, and Manipulation. And it basically is a study of fake news and what it is as a semantical product and why it has the proficiency to spread as the way we have seen. Now, that to me is making science feed into grander issues.
Yeah. Tell me, let's describe it. Why don't you, if you wouldn't mind, telling us a little bit about Reality Lost and what, what has gone into this book? Obviously, yeah, you kind of, you know, I think you've done a nice job connecting why some of what you do or what you can do is certainly important. What does this book address? And what can readers who are interested in downloading it take from it?
Okay, so the book came out in, I wrote it with my PhD student. His name is Mads Vestergaard, and we wrote it because we wrote it last year in 17, and it came out in Danish. And there was no systematic analysis in Danish of the market of attention and how fake news as a subprime information product can actually prosper and live fairly robustly on non-regulated information markets. And then it was translated into German and has actually been nominated for Science Book of the Year in Germany. It's called Postfaktisch. And then I wanted to have it out in English, or we wanted to, and so we did. But the way we wanted to do it was that I just recently came back from Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, where I gave a keynote at the UN summit there misinformation and fake news for all the statistical offices of the African continent. And the entire point now is that, of course, the Africans are afraid that the Chinese are going to take all their raw materials and the tech giants are going to take their attention. So the entire point of launching the book, we launched the book in Addis Ababa, in Ethiopia, not 3 weeks ago, with the message that we might be emancipating lightning information will take your attention, but it's not going to take your data, it's not going to take your money, and it's not going to turn you into a product for the social media. So therefore, we relinquish this book for free to the entire world for them to get the idea of the structure and the nuts and bolts of the information market to make sure that we can actually live in and got preventive means for not selling out our self-determination while being products for the social media.
Wow. Well, I think, I was just going to ask, what is the decision to release the book? But I imagine, there's a lot of good reasons to do so. How was the participation at the summit? What was that like in kind of connecting these things?
Well, it was very interesting because there were delegates from every country on the African continent. And you have to realize that a lot of these emerging democracies have had severe problems with fake news campaigns in their elections. Kenya 2013 and 17, Nigeria, Tanzania, you name it. And so it was very well received, and they know that this is an issue. Not only the Western world is fighting fake news, the third world is too. The only problem is, of course, that they are less robust democracies, well, at least in principles, than the ones that we are having. But be that as it may, it created quite a splash, and people were interested. And they could see the point about why we had released it under those open access circumstances, because the kind of information that should qualify your decision making should be something that you pay for with your attention, but not with your data, and not with your money, and not in such a way that you become more or less the commodity being sold.
Very good. So for other philosophers, folks either in epistemology or philosophy of science or elsewhere who are interested in contributing into these kinds of questions and these kinds of problems, do you have any advice or recommendations or any experience with working with others who in some ways could do this kind of work that, you know, on the one hand is, you know, you're still doing philosophy in many ways for its intellectual merit, but at the same time, you're connected with a more broader impact purpose?
Sure. One of the things that one has to realize is that the kind of problems that this world is facing, not surprisingly, are extremely complex. So if you're just purely trained in philosophy and you want to contribute, then you're going to have to sit down and bite the bullet and know something about other disciplines, whether it might be political science on one hand, math or computer science on the third, depending on where you want to, what kind of, or social psychology or economics, before you can actually engage, because you're going to have to know something about what sort of teeth you're going to need in order to bite this apple. And philosophy teeth by themselves are not sharp enough for that. So from that perspective, you're going to have to spend some time studying other disciplines, not such that you get master's degree in everything or PhDs in economics and philosophy and soc sci in order to do this, but at least have an operating working knowledge of other disciplines. And then you're going to have to look at things in a little bit of a different light. When you got interesting examples of, say, misinformation, then you ask yourself, what is the structure of this problem? I mean, realize this. So the reason why there was a couple of reasons, personal reasons, why I got into this field. And one was my son, namely that when he was 10 or 11, and that was 2010 or 2011, he came home with a story from school where he goes, listen, Dad, I took over an Instagram profile from one of my friends. And I was like, yuppie-doo. He's like, well, he had 3,000 followers. And I was like, so? Whoa. And he goes, well, look, then over the weekend, we took a stroll down one of the big pedestrian streets in Copenhagen. There were some rappers there that are really famous. So we took a couple of selfies with these guys, and we put them on the Instagram profile. And all of a sudden, the number rose from 3,000 to 9,500. And I was like, yeah, so? And he goes, well, today in school, Anton asked me whether or not he could buy the profile for money. And I was like, wait a minute here. So what you're telling me is that there's so much social capital in that profile that is actually now worth real money. I got to understand this kind of economics. I don't understand this. So then I started to study attention economics, and I started to study all these other issues that sort of feeds into it. But my point I'm trying to make here is that it actually, this example turned into a structural study or a structural question for me. How does this work? I got to understand this. And so you got to have to look at philosophy from a different kind of lens, a lens in which philosophy is committed to, by its very nature, not to basically be part of the world, be part of the problems that are there and also part of the solutions. And the way in which philosophy is taught in many ways, it tends to seem very secluded from the kind of world that we are in. Not that it is, but the levels of abstraction that you have to go through in order to get to the bone is pretty severe often.
Yeah.
And from there on out, it's not too hard. And I think it's fair to say that a lot of people working in philosophy, whether it'll be feminist philosophy or questions of trust or social epistemology, etc., are all interested in the real world problem in a pretty real way.
Yeah.
And it also goes to show that philosophy, by its very nature, is an interdisciplinary study. All that philosophy really means is love of wisdom. Well, that goes for everything in every discipline, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. No, but I think you make a good point, and I like how you've explored these other areas. You kind of follow what you need to do to answer and address the problems. And I think, yeah, you hit it, you get at it very closely that a lot of the formal instruction initially in philosophy is somewhat of a secluded nature. And so, branching out, I mean, maybe that's a good thing for at least the time being, at least getting down the skills that you need to take,
sure.
You need to be disciplined in some capacity, but,
sure.
But eventually, right, if you want to engage with this stuff, if you want to have something to say, you got to learn a little bit about whatever it is you're talking about. And usually quite a bit.
Right. I mean, Steve, was it Bertrand Russell or Stephen Wine? Oh, no. It was, what is his name? Feynman. Richard Feynman once said, philosophers incidentally have a great deal to say about what is absolutely necessary for science. And it is, as far as I can see, rather naive and probably wrong. So do you want to be a philosopher of science along those lines? I don't think so.
No, definitely not. So tell us a little bit about, current, catching us up. So current projects and perhaps future projects. I imagine, you've just finished a book, so maybe a lot of that is going on and kind of trying to market and sort of go around and talk about the book a bit, defend the works. But, just catch us up. What's been going on with you lately?
Okay, so we have been doing this fake news tour now or misinformation and fake news tour now for a good two and a half years now. So things are branching out in different ways. I personally, with a couple of my colleagues at the Center for Information and Bubble Studies, are now trying to get down cold some formal models of attention economics. From a logical perspective. So that's what research-wise is going on at the time for what's one part. Another part is that we are developing some games for people to understand what lemming effects and wisdom of crowds are all about. But an interesting thing about once we start to develop these games, computer games, it turns out that some of the old dogmas of these different issues are not quite true. So there are ways in which one should regiment what you're doing in order to get this to work properly. And so there's some new research results in that as well. And eventually, I have to write up this book that's just called Bubbles.
Yeah, we got to know. Yeah.
But that's on a little longer time scale before I write that one. But that's definitely something that I probably have to do to end the circle.
Right. I would be intrigued. I would certainly be interested. So if in this book, what do you think would go into the bubbles? Would this just kind of be a nice overview of your work, of the concept, why it's important?
No, it's going to be more than that. It's going to be to make the argument stick mathematically, experimentally, and philosophically that there are other kinds of bubbles than financial bubbles, and that they could be looked at in much the same way that financial bubbles are being looked at in different ways. So a Twitter storm is essentially, or a shitstorm, excuse my French, is essentially an aggregate of anger from a lot of different nodes in a network, independently of whether they necessarily know what the case is all about, or even if it's at all required to get a shitstorm that you know what it is about. And what the studies tend to show these days, and there's a book to be recommended here, that's Jonah Berger, who's a marketing professor at the Wharton Institute in Pennsylvania, wrote a very interesting book. It's called Contagious, Why Ideas Spread Online. And one of the things he figures out that there are certain sentiments that tends to be shared a lot, or information with certain sentiments. And those sentiments are anger and fear and indignation. So what's called negative activity mobilizing sentiments. So anger is a negative activity mobilizing sentiment, because once I get angry, I want to do something about it. I want to share, I want to click, I want to so forth and so forth. So anger is extremely contagious. But happiness is not necessarily contagious. That it's a state that you are in, but it doesn't animate you to do something. So happiness is a positive but negative but activity demobilizing sentiment. And so there's a whole lacuna to be explored here as to the way in which the sentiments that tends to get us to share things, whether or not they are justified or not, insofar as to follow the facts or not. And so from that perspective, I would have to tell the full story of why attention is the new acid, and that you can unjustifiably overheat the acid and then get situations which are pretty close to the kinds that you find in finance, namely that bubbles burst and there's no fundamental value. That means there's no truth underlying it. So let me give you an example of that.
Yeah.
So in the early 2000s, Alan Greenspan, who was running the Federal Reserve, had this idea that if you deregulate and liberalize financial markets, and if the markets are very liquid, then in the end, only the good products, the good services will survive, and the rest will get weeded out during given the competition. And that will be the best possible model for growth, because in this fierce competition, only the good products would survive. So when we get the subprime crisis in 08, even Alan Greenspan had to say, well, that's not quite the way it works. There is actually a market for subprime financial products that will take out huge shares of what's going on. But once you look into what they are really not very good. That's really not very good credit. It's not good mortgage. And so, and then hence, there is a market for subprime financial products that can actually live long and prosper on deregulated financial markets. And if you look at the information market as an intention economy, there is a market for subprime information products that will allocate a lot of attention independently of whether they're actually true. And so there is a market for fake news, whether that is for agenda setting or making money or marketing or propaganda. And that's the entire argument that we present in this Reality Lost book, just in a very systematic way.
Very nice, very nice. Well, I'll try to include a link in the show notes here, and for any of our listeners who actually want to download this book for free, that'll be great. Well, why don't we come to one of the final questions that I have of many of our guests, which is, what do you see to be the greatest challenge facing philosophy of science today?
The gravest challenge facing philosophy of science today?
It's
getting close enough to science. I mean, look, if you really want to do philosophy of science with a bite, if you want to do philosophy of physics, say, with a bite, you're going to have to learn no physics really well. Now, there's some great philosophers of physics out there, but there are not too many, basically because they have to train a lot to become good physics first and then good philosophers of physics second, or inverse order, as you please.
Yeah.
And the same goes for math. The same goes for chemistry, biology, social science, political science. Take your favorite pick. So I think it's fair to say that if you want to be a good philosopher of science, then you have to be pretty close to the science that you're interested in. And from that perspective, make sure that you take a lot of courses if you're interested in political science, if you're interested in physics or chemistry or biology or climate studies or what have you. Make sure that you take a lot of hands-on courses in those fields, because you're going to need it if you want to get these different scientists into play and listen to you. So you will not end up with detached philosophy of science from the science that you're really interested in commenting on, making better, problematizing, whatever it is that your ambition is.
Thank you. So this is certainly a concern of many other philosophers of science. In your experience, it seems like you've mentioned you go out and you lurk and you work with the scientists. How do you personally like to interact with other scientists and or other, I mean, folks in the disciplines in economics, political science? Like, what do you and in your folks do?
I usually attend to these issues in a very modest way, in the sense of saying, I don't know, but you're the expert here. So tell me a little bit about X, Y, and Z. And let me tell you why I'm interested in this. And is there any way in which what I'm interested in has anything to do with your science at all? or could you look at it from this perspective? So yeah. I tend to show Socratic modesty, yeah? It's not to say the only thing I know is that I don't, because I do know something. But I do know that that what I'm trying to do on a regular basis when I interact with scientists is to present with some very clear, crisp, concise problems that I have. Not sort of painting a grander picture of such and so, but understanding what a greater fool's theory is in economics, or understanding how time series analysis works for predicting the value of stock or something like that. And so ask the scientists something very precise so they know and can see that I'm not presenting a red herring here. This is an issue because such and so. So be very well versed and ask clear, crisp, and concise questions.
Very good advice. So, before we go, I know you've mentioned your son asking some really great philosophical questions, pointed questions. Do you see him? Are you grooming him in terms of encouraging a philosophy degree out of him? No,
no way.
No way. No. Do something else.
That's his choice completely. But I can tell you already, he wants to be a journalist, so he's not going after dad.
Okay. Yeah, I've just been impressed. That's something I don't always ask, is the way in which our families can kind of impact the way, you know, what we question, what matters to us. And it seems like very much in your experience, you mentioned two such experiences where, you know, these questions from family have interested you and sort of steered you a certain way.
And steered me very strongly in one way or the other.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, look, and this might sound a little glorious, but look, I can't bear the idea that we are going to be riding on the Enlightenment in the information age, the first generation that leaves a world worse off to our kids than the one we got from our parents.
Yeah.
I can't have it. And we're going to have, science is going to help us solve that one. I tell you that much. And if the way I do science can just have a little bit of a say in that regard, then I consider myself to having satisfied my call as a scientist. I never call myself a philosopher. I'm a professor of philosophy, maybe. But I'm trying to just follow the rules of science and getting some results. That's all.
Fair enough. Well, Vincent, I really appreciate you taking the time to chat and fill us in on what's going on with you and tell us a little bit about your origin story and your work. It's been great to get to know you. Is there anything else you'd like to leave us with? Any current updates, information, plugs for certain projects?
I would say this. I really like the University of Indiana in Bloomington. I was there maybe 4 years ago, 5 years ago, as a visiting professor.
Oh, really? In philosophy or in?
With Larry Moss.
Yeah, Larry. Oh, you came. Yeah, yeah. Larry Moss. Yeah, he runs the Logic Seminar.
Yeah, Larry Moss, who's a good friend, and also Robert Becker. I go to the economics department. That was just when we finished our first book on these issues, called InfoStorms, explaining individual behavior on the social net. So I was there for almost 3 weeks, and I really enjoyed Indiana, and I really enjoyed University of Indiana, Bloomington, and I think you're doing important work for you're doing important work for humanity and the world in times of trouble.
Well, it's good to engage, and I think I could certainly say the same of you. The way in which you're reaching out, connecting, getting some of this hopefully important information out there, and and how we're concerned about it and how we're addressing it, I think is important. So I appreciate the kind words, and I'm glad you enjoyed Indiana.
I certainly did, sir.
Yeah, well, if you ever come visit, please, you're always welcome. Hope to meet you in person someday. But
you certainly got it, Nick.
Yeah, but otherwise, yeah. Enjoy the rest of your semester. Enjoy the Indian summer in Copenhagen, and yeah, we'll be in touch soon.
Thank you very much, Nick. Thank you, sir.
All right, take care, Vincent. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.